Hoodoo plant mamas, get your soul fed and your spirit red.
This here is my strength. I possess the power from way back when. Back when folk were stripped from all of their kin, so they had to find the magic within. Ancestors gather my herbs, I conjure at my altar. Hoodoo plant mama, I manifest growth and I release trauma.
Child, we just out here trying to water our plants and mind our business, you know? Everybody ain't from the deep south, man. Everybody can't have culture like us.
Hey, y'all, and welcome back to another episode of Hoodoo Plant Mamas. I am your co-host, Leah Nicole.
And I'm Danny B.
And today we have a guest who is returning to the podcast. Gray, would you like to reintroduce yourself?
Hi. Yes, my name is Gray. The previous podcast that we episode that we recorded, I was using the name Tasha primarily. I still use that name, but Gray has jumped on board as well. So I'm Tasha Gray. I am an occupational therapist. I'm currently working in the school district, and then I also have a private practice. And typically I work with neurodivergent kids.
We're super excited to have you here. Before we get started, let's get into our usual check-in. Leah, we can start with you. Well, actually, Gray, we can start with you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little sleepy. I stayed up until 3 a.m. I started hyper-focusing on making a song. So right on topic, my neurodivergent brain had me up just exploring things that I love to do. So I'm tired, but I also feel very good, very full from spending the night just doing things that I love.
What about you, Leah?
Similar, I'm also tired. I have my sister and my nephews here, so there's a four-year-old running around, and he has more energy than everyone else in the house combined. So overall, I'm doing pretty okay. How about you, Danny?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited about this episode. So I'm feeling good today. Let's get into some gratitude. I can start with saying I'm thankful to have Gray here. I'm thankful to be alive. I had a nightmare last night and somebody died. And so I spoke to that person. I did not tell them I had that dream, but I spoke to the person and they're fine. So I'm feeling grateful about that because I really don't like dreams like that. So yeah, I'm very grateful to just be here and to have my loved ones. What about you, Leah?
By the time this podcast comes out, my book will be out, Apocalypse Steel. I am just grateful that I had the skills and resources to make it happen. I'm grateful for my ancestors who have given me the guidance and the support that I need to make it happen. And so, yes, that's what I'm grateful for today. What about you, Gray?
I'm going to throw a compliment back. I'm very grateful for the two of you, Danny and Leah, for inviting me back on the show to talk about the thing that I'm always running my mouth about every single day. So I have a lot of gratitude just for having the opportunity to talk again and to not feel shamed for loving to talk about something like this.
We are so happy to have you because there's so much that we want to talk about. I know when I first came across the term neurodivergent, it made complete sense to me. And I vividly remember being in college. And several times I would be given an assignment where the professor would give us all the same directions. Everybody in the class would do something in a similar way. And then I would do something completely different. And I would be like, where are they? I was so confused about how everyone was on the same consensus. I was like, what am I doing wrong? And it didn't matter if it was an art class or a creative writing class. It just seemed like my brain processed things differently than my peers. And I remember thinking everybody else thinks like an apple, and you know, there are green apples and there are red apples and all these different type of apples. I think like an orange, and that's okay because we're both fruit. And that was how I made sense of how my brain worked. And so, Gray, I'm wondering, could you explain what neurodiversity is and what it means to be neurodivergent?
I sure can. First, I just want to say my favorite thing about people who are different is the fact that they internally already know what's up. Like, you were able to make that connection on your own without extra support to identify like, I'm different, you know, I'm different and that's okay. And I love that. That's like a superpower of a lot of neurodivergent folks that I've, you know, come across, you know, in my work experience. So yes, to start, neurodiversity in essentially is a concept or a thought that everybody's brain is different. Exactly what you came to the conclusion of in your experience at school. There's no one normal or typical brain. There's a diverse range of brains and how they operate. I think the idea of having a typical brain honestly is rooted in all the isms that you can name, right? Essentially white supremacy, because we know that society tries to force us to fit in a certain box in the way that we present behaviorally in the world. But it's not innate to present like everyone else. We all have our own brains. They're all wired differently. Therefore, neurodiversity just means that everybody's brain is different. And it's about empowering and really changing the effort to like pathologize people with different brains and normalize the fact that we all have our own like brains and we should embrace that. So what it means to be neurodivergent, different from neurodiversity, because again, neurodiversity just means everybody's brain is different. Neurodivergent specifically means that you have a specific diagnosis, or you present with characteristics of a specific diagnosis. For example, it could be ADHD, it could be autism, OCD, dyslexia, it could be PTSD. There's so many different diagnoses under the neurodivergent umbrella. And something else I think that is important to name and to recognize is that not everybody has access to the tools and the resources that are required to get diagnoses. So to be quite honest, I feel like there are a lot of people existing in the world that don't have a specific diagnosis, but they're presenting as if they have a specific diagnosis or characteristics of a diagnosis. So again, neurodivergent is just someone who's impacted by the characteristics of whether it is a specific diagnosis that they receive from a doctor or an undiagnosed diagnosis or expression of a diagnosis.
I resonate with what you said, Leah, about your brain working differently as a kid, because I told you this, Gray, one time on the phone about how I'm not gonna say what it was, but there's this specific thing that you're supposed to do, like hygiene wise, that I, as a kid, my grandmother, my mom, a bunch of people in my life was telling me, hey, this is how you do this particular thing. Well, to me, that didn't make no sense. So I didn't do it. I paid for it later. But that was the kind of thing as a kid, like if it didn't make sense to me, I just wasn't going to do it. Sometimes to a fault. But I'm glad you said that. And I'm glad you made that point, Gray, about neurodiversity and the fact that everybody's unique in how their brain processes things. Because you're exactly right. This idea of normal is so problematic. There are people that they may not realize it, but they're forcing themselves to be what is, you know, considered normal. A lot of people are not honoring themselves. And it's hard because we get socialized in a particular way. So I think I'm so glad that you made that distinction about neurodiversity and like this idea of a normal brain.
It's really hard to exist in society without, you know, assimilating to any degree. It's just really hard to exist. And something that I've found myself, even in my practice when I work with kids, is that a lot of times kids will have a very specific way to do a thing, you know, as I'm trying to teach a skill. And I, in my brain, I'll have this really specific way that I want to teach this skill because you need to do this thing in this particular way because it worked for me, right? And then every single time I take that approach with my kids, they show me there are other ways to do things. There are other ways to do it. And Gray, you do not have to be rigid in the way that you do things and project that on other people. That is a constant lesson that I'm learning because like you said, Danny, when you're a child, you're just like, if it makes sense, it makes sense. I'm going to do it that way. If it don't make sense, it don't make sense. I'm not going to do it. I get it. I'm the same way. And so shout out to the kids for always checking me to remind me that there are different ways to do things.
So last year, Danny and I, we had a Patreon mini-show called Country Black, and we tackled some different Black experiences that often aren't considered or centered in like mainstream conversations of Blackness. One thing that we talked about was neurodivergent Black people. And some common sentiments are that neurodivergent Black people are quote unquote trying to be white, are anti-Black, have a superiority complex. And I think a lot of that is a misinterpretation of people who may not understand social or cultural cues, or who have a flat affect, which can show up as like a neutral facial expression or a monotone voice. And so I'm wondering if you ever come across these misconceptions about neurodiversity and how it affects Black people in your work or in your life.
Yes, I have a lot of thoughts. First, you mentioned that a lot of times folks will assume that neurodivergent Black folks are just trying to be white. And I want to circle back to something I said a little bit earlier, is I think that the idea of having a typical or a normal brain is rooted in white supremacy. So if that is the case, why is it difficult for folks to consider the idea that us presenting in society in a typical way is actually us trying to be white? Like, is us not masking an attempt at us gaining closer proximity to cis white men, you know, so that we can have the same successes as cis white men, or so that we can have the same ease in life as everyone else, you know, that's not a person of color, that's not Black. And so I think it's important, again, to highlight the fact that when we hide parts of ourselves, when we mask, when we don't show up as our full neurodivergent, authentic selves, it is a direct correlation to white supremacy. So I wanted to say that, because that in itself just can counter the idea that neurodivergent Black folks are gaining or attempting to gain closer proximity to whiteness, because it's just not that. Other misconceptions, there are many. One being that neurodivergence is equal to autism. And again, it's okay, you know, to have that misconception, but important to just learn, to be educated, to have a better understanding of what it means to be neurodivergent. Again, the neurodivergent umbrella includes a variety of diagnoses. A lot of times folks will hear neurodivergence and immediately think that everyone under the umbrella is the same, that every strategy that works for one neurodivergent person should work for another, when that's just not the case. Again, all of our brains are different. That means all of our brains require different supports. I think another really major misconception as far as the movement, the neurodiversity movement goes, is people can often think that this movement is something that minimizes the experiences of physically disabled people, just because a lot of the neurodivergent diagnoses are not ones that can be seen easily. Sometimes these diagnoses are referred to as invisible diagnoses. So they're not things that you can just look at a person and say, oh, you got a diagnosis, in the same way that you can look at someone who may be physically disabled and identify that they have a disability. I think that the neurodiversity movement, the goal is, again, to empower people to show up as their authentic selves, to change the efforts of people to pathologize invisible disabilities, and also to highlight the strengths and the beauty and just the awesomeness that neurodivergent folks are. And so, yeah, those are some of the misconceptions that I definitely encounter in the work that I do and in just in regular lived experience.
I'm glad that you brought up that a common misconception is that all neurodivergent people are the same. Something I found is that even under diagnosis, people will think that people with the same diagnosis need to act the same or need to be the same. I see it a lot with autism, because someone, two diagnosed autistic people can be nothing alike, and people will be like, oh, that person must be pretending. They're not actually autistic, but they're both diagnosed, you know?
Intimate self-disclosure here. I recently got a diagnosis of both autism and ADHD. And something that I struggle with, like for real, is the fact that I look totally different from a lot of people who are diagnosed with both autism and ADHD. I think that a part of my neurodivergence looks like mastery of masking, unfortunately. But like all my life, I've been taught to present in this way. It goes, I can even remember like being a child watching home videos over and over and over, just trying to learn like how do people exist so that I can replicate that. And so now in my adult life, I'm able to show up in a way where I can talk to anybody, you know, because I have those scripts. I have that practice of knowing how to people. And so a lot of times when I think of myself as an autistic or ADHD individual, I'm like, dang, can I really even claim this? Because essentially I'm neurotypical passing, you know, I can pass, I can walk in the room of a million people and nobody's going to look at me and say, oh, that person's different. That person's autistic. So that's definitely something that it's a challenge to navigate every single day, especially with this new diagnosis.
I've been wondering if a lot of that is like being socialized as a Black girl and being told like, here are the certain ways that you're allowed to be. I remember as a child, I was told I was dramatic, I was overreacting, I was exaggerating, I was sensitive, I needed to quit being that. And I would get punished for expressing myself in those ways. So it was like, I had to mask. I didn't really have any other options. So I'm wondering if like, for a lot of Black kids who may not be seen as neurodivergent because they have had to mask, because of anti-Blackness, because of misogyny, because of these things.
I think you make great points. You really do. Again, when I self-reflect and I think about my upbringing, at least the parts that I can remember, I can identify very specific moments where I had shifts in my behavior in the interactions that I had with my family. For example, there might have been a time where I was just doing the absolute most. I'm goofy. I'm loud. I'm moving. I'm jumping. I'm da-da-da-da. But somebody told me I needed to sit down and shut up and be quiet, you know? So then I had to learn how to sit down and shut up and be quiet. And that goes for many different behaviors. I think back to, and I compare myself to my siblings sometimes, and I'm like, man, I really learned a lot from them. Like I watched the ways that they had challenges in interacting with the family. And to be quite honest, I avoided a lot of punishment and things like that because I learned like, oh, what they did gets you in trouble. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to hide my desire to do that thing. So I do think it is a common thing. I do think it's a common thing in the Black household because we know Black mamas everywhere with their little, I don't know, belt of a voice. Sit down, shut up, act right. You know, this is how you need to present in the world in order to be safe. This is how you need to present in the world in order to be accepted. And this is how you need to present in the world in order to thrive and be successful. And so that is those are all things that both neurodivergent and folks who are not on the neurodivergent spectrum experience living in Black households, for sure.
I'm going to talk about this more later, but that definitely goes into this idea that a lot of us heard growing up, which is children are to be seen and not heard, because I heard that often and I internalized it. And I've talked to Gray about this, but and you too, Leah, I feel like if I had been able to like be myself as a child, if I had been affirmed more in some of my quirkiness, I would probably be a different person. I was shut down a lot as a child. And I think I went through periods of just feeling invisible and just wanting attention. And I was just always kind of, you know, treated like I was doing too much. Like, you're too loud, be quiet, shut up, get out of grown folks' business, da-da-da-da-da. It's always just shutting children down. And so many of us now are trying to unpack that as adults. So many of us have went years, decades being someone else. And now we barely can function. Like I believe a lot of my social anxiety and the fact that I be so isolated, or sometimes I don't leave my house for weeks because of that, because I'm always overthinking every little interaction, every little interaction.
Yeah, I think that speaks to, again, the idea that a lot of people, especially a lot of Black folks, are out here navigating life with these undiagnosed but very significantly impacting characteristics of neurodivergence. PTSD, that's one of the diagnoses under the umbrella. And a lot of Black folks in childhood experience these significant levels of trauma that honestly people don't even recognize as trauma. It's so normalized to tell your kids to sit down, to shut up, to be quiet, to become invisible, to be quite honest. And so, yeah, I feel for you, Danny. I feel for everybody in the world that is trying their best to just unravel and undo all the ways that that level of trauma has, you know, impacted them to being this person who just is having a hard time existing in society.
So another thing I wanted to discuss, we all on here have a spiritual practice, and I wanted to know for you, Gray, can you talk about the relationship between your spiritual practice and being neurodivergent? Like, how does it impact how you engage in your spiritual practice or how you engage with your ancestors? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. I think it directly relates to literally what we were just talking about, unpacking those traumas from childhood. I think my current focus in my spiritual practice right now is trying to get back to my authentic self, trying to get back to being who I was when I was born. Because something that I'm starting to realize, especially through working with children, is that kids being their most authentic self, they know exactly what they need. They know exactly what they like, and they know exactly what they do not like. Kids are not yet 100% socialized to present in the world in the way that adults are socialized and how they present in the world. And so again, my current spiritual practice is like, okay, what did I like to do as a kid? What was the weird stuff that I liked to do when I was a kid? And can I start doing that stuff again? Can I go outside and be in front of a group of people and dance if I want to dance and it doesn't make sense? You know, can I be in a work meeting and be rocking back and forth, you know, in a way that may be perceived as a disruption in the meeting, but it's something that feels good to my body? And I think that my efforts to reconnect with my inner child, to be quite honest, is a spiritual practice in and of itself. I'm trying to like unravel and undo all the ways that society has convinced me to to abandon myself and to disown those parts of myself. I feel like I identify as a really highly intuitive person. And I realize that a lot of the times when I'm navigating day-to-day life, I doubt my intuition. One thing I'm going to do is look for a societal reason to justify my intuition before I just trust it. But what I'm learning is that my childlike intuition is very much guided by my ancestors, is very much guided by my connectedness to spirit, to the world around me. And so it is a daily practice for me to honestly like encounter those thoughts that society put in my brain and also be like, no, you're not gonna win this fight. Like, I get to trust my intuition. I get to remain connected to spirit in the way that I choose, in the way that I did when I was a child. So yeah, I think that's my current spiritual practice as it relates to neurodivergence.
I agree with that. And I think children are so spiritually attuned. And I love that you said, like, be in front of people and just dance, because I used to do stuff like that. Like, there was a period in my childhood that I didn't really have an awareness of an audience, of thinking about my surrounding as an audience. And when I became aware, that is literally, that was the wheels turning of me becoming the person I am today. Because I'm so hyper aware of an audience now, even though there isn't one or shouldn't be one. But I do think that returning to the self is ancestral work. I really do. I think it strengthens that connection and allows us to be more spiritually open when we return to that self, because you are so much more open as a child, and we lose that. A lot of us lose that in adulthood, and that's a part of that journey. And I feel like that's also a part of my journey as well. Let's get into some ways you can support the Hoodoo Plant Mamas. One is through our bookshop, where you can buy the books that we previously discussed. We have a Hoodoo Beginner's Guide. Leah and I share our top reading picks, and we have the books from our Writing the Spirit guests. Every purchase you make helps support our show. Check us out at bookshop.org/shop/Hoodoo Plant Mamas or the link in our show notes.
Other ways you can support us include rating and reviewing the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Hoodoo Plants and Instagram at Hoodoo Plant Mamas. Check out our Patreon, where we share exclusive video, plant, and spiritual content for only $3 a month. If you prefer a one-time donation, you can donate via Cash App, hashtag Hoodoo Plant Mamas, or our PayPal, hoodooplantmamas@gmail.com. Let's get back to the show.
So, kind of returning to this discussion about children, I'm thinking a lot about our episode from season 2, Children Are Divine, and just the ways people regard children, especially Black children. And Gray, you and I have discussed this often because you work with neurodivergent children in our community. And I know this too from when I was a teacher, so I'm also speaking from experience. Parents, Black parents, have a hard time accepting that their kids might be neurodivergent, might have ADHD, might have autism, might have something that is interfering with their ability to function in class. Like, their struggle is rooted in that. And instead, it becomes like a judgment of the child's character. I had a parent tell me, he's just bad. He's just doing this. Like, we've went through several schools and we've had this problem, because she was very resistant to us for him having an IEP, which, what is an IEP? Can you just explain it? Because I don't want to explain it wrong.
Yes. Essentially, an IEP is an individualized education plan. It's put in place for students to identify, you know, their areas of need, to identify what kind of supports they need, and also to offer them additional supports in the school system so that they're able to access their education.
I'm not saying this to shame parents, because a lot of it is also, I don't want my child labeled. And that's fair, especially when you're dealing with the educational system, where there's a lot of racist shit happening to kids. Okay. And so they can come across the wrong teacher, and it becomes a problem. That teacher has already made a decision about that child. So I completely understand that. It's also complicated, because it's strange that on one hand, people struggle to see the humanity of children, but then on the other hand, they expect them to manage their emotions in ways many adults can't. And so it's weird to kind of like, when a child is acting out or engaging in a behavior that's disruptive maybe to their peers, to the teacher, and to themselves, that it's a character flaw in a child. A character flaw. And I think about this a lot as someone who had issues as a kid that was brushed off as having an attitude, being ungrateful, being bad. When I was going through what I now know were symptoms of like post-traumatic stress, which I don't really like the term, but that's the language we have. And so I'm interested to know, Gray, what have you learned about childhood and neurodivergence and race since you've been working with and supporting neurodivergent children?
Yeah, this is such a layered thing. And I think that's because I empathize with everybody involved. And I think it's hard to have a conversation about neurodivergence in the Black household without bringing up white supremacy and the way that racism has impacted Black people as a whole. I oftentimes will think about like the why, like why are Black parents doing this? Like, our parents don't want to hurt us. They don't, you know, want to be a contributing factor of trauma for us, right? But they're doing it for a reason. And to be quite honest, when I think about it, I always fall back on safety. Like, for all of our lived experiences, Black people, we are constantly living in a fight or flight like space, to be quite honest. And it may look different depending on scenarios, but we are the global majority, but we are not treated as such. We are treated as though we have to conform. We have to be quiet. We have to tame our hair. We've got to tame our outward appearance. We've got to tame our behavioral expressions in order to fit, in order to thrive, and to be successful in a white supremacist society. And I think because of that, our parents have just internalized the idea that if I don't come down hard on my child, if I don't help my child learn how to mask themselves and hide themselves, then my child is not safe. Then my child will not thrive. Then my child will not be taken care of. And so I empathize hard because that's just a fact. That's just our lived experience. And it can be difficult with that for parents to be flexible and open to shifting that mindset, to shifting that way of existing in a way to honor their kid as authentically as their kid shows up. And more so, like, I think it makes it difficult for parents to even be able to conceptualize the idea of having a child who is empowered, who can advocate for themselves, who can show up in the world in a way that looks different. It's hard for a parent to conceptualize that, a Black parent. So like I said, it's very, very layered. Related to what I've learned, related to neurodivergence, Black children and their family dynamics, is one, shifting is not an overnight process. I think that something that I have learned to reprioritize in my work is, to be quite honest, leaning more into supporting the parents as opposed to leaning into identifying needs or identifying challenges for the kid. And I say that to say, oftentimes when I bring awareness to what neurodiversity and neurodivergence is in a way that a Black parent can understand and conceptualize, it ends up triggering this self-reflection period where then Black parents are able to sit and be like, what does that look like for me as an individual? Unrelated to my child, what does neurodiversity and neurodivergence mean to me? And having the ability to self-reflect and find all the ways that themselves as a Black parent have been forced to hide themselves, have been forced to tame them, you know, tame their outward appearance. Once you start generating those types of thoughts, it becomes much easier for Black parents to then generate those same types of thoughts as it relates to their kids. But again, like I said, it's not an overnight process. And then it comes with a lot of re-experiencing trauma, to be honest, which is, it's terrifying, but also it's quite important if you have a Black child to do some unraveling with yourself and understanding how the world has impacted you. And then therefore using that understanding of that knowledge to look at your child in a way where it's like, I don't want you to have to unravel this in your adulthood. I want you to be able to know who you are, love who you are, show up as who you are. And if somebody don't like it, all right, that's their problem. That ain't got nothing to do with me, you know? So I think it's a very complex relationship with neurodivergent parents, Black parents and their kids that I wish more people had support in navigating. But yeah.
I wanted to make a disclaimer. I know most people will understand, but I want to be clear that this isn't a generalization of Black parents, because I know plenty of Black parents that are, particularly millennial parents, that are really trying to change the narrative, You know, I see millennial parents arguing all the time on the internet with people trying to shame them for gentle parenting, people trying to misrepresent gentle parenting to make excuses for why they want to beat on their kids, or try to make a distinction between beating and whooping. And it's like, no, there isn't a distinction. Sorry, in my opinion. So yeah, so this isn't a generalization. I feel like, but a lot of Black parents, because a lot of us grew up with Black parents, some of us may be Black parents or have worked with children, see a pattern. So I just wanted to say that just in case, because sometimes people will, you know, I don't think most of our listeners are like that, but I just felt the need to say that.
No, I appreciate you for saying it. It's important to say. Oftentimes I have conversations with parents, and one of the things that I will say to them, because again, parents be stressed, and I'm not a parent. So like, I can empathize all day, but baby, I don't know what it feels like to be a parent. And so to be quite honest, as often as I can say it to parents, specifically Black parents, I'm telling you how revolutionary you are to just be existing in a space where you're even thinking about what it means to be neurodivergent. Like, consider that as a fact. Nobody in the past really was sitting down being like, oh, what does it mean, you know, to have a different brain? And what does it look like to support my child? If you even just do the bare minimum of thinking and considering and initiating your self-reflective process, that is an act of revolution. That is something to be commended. You know, even if you don't feel like you're the most gentle parent, you're doing your best. And I think it deserves recognition. People deserve to be recognized. Black parents deserve to be recognized as true revolutionaries in this day and age, regardless of how they parent.
Y'all kept talking about like white supremacy and then PTSD. And it just made me think a lot about the trauma of slavery and how a lot of times it was best for children to be invisible and to fit in and not stand out for the risk of being sold or punished. And I wonder if a lot of the dehumanization that we've internalized, that we've passed on to kids, that we've accepted for so long, has to do with this. Like the whole, you have to mask, you have to behave in this way. It's just like another product of slavery.
Listen, that thought be stressing me out, because I'm like, dang, what's not a product? Like, what is not? To be quite honest, I can't find anything. It's a stressful thought, but you're right. I do think it is. Granted, I don't have the data, the scientific research, but it's hard not to see the fact that it is a direct correlation to slavery.
So for me, my life completely changed once I started to accommodate myself. And I could already see the ways that I was doing it. Like my friend, when she would come see me in college, she was like, you always keep it so cold and dark and quiet in here. And she was like, your room's a cave. But that was just like, it was calming to me to do that. And so other ways that I have accommodated myself is using subtitles more, because I have trouble like understanding what people are saying as they talk, turning down my screen brightness, leaving a place if it's too noisy or if the smell triggers me, instead of trying to power through it and ending up with a migraine later. I'm using grocery store pickup to avoid the bright lights and the loud noises of the stores, wearing masks so I don't have to worry about making the right facial expression, not defaulting to smiling or injecting intonation into my voice. I used to get in trouble a lot in high school. I was in this like speech and debate thing. And so my teacher, he would always be like, your voice is very flat and it would trill up in. So I had to practice going up and down with my voice. Stimming is a big one for me. So stimming is a self-stimulatory repetitive movement. And I found out that if I don't stim enough throughout the day, at night I'm like super jittery and I can't sleep. And so just sometimes at night I have to get out of bed and just like shake myself for a few minutes and then I'll go right to sleep. So Gray, I'm wondering, what are some accommodations that you think would be helpful, not just for neurodivergent children, but like for adults who suspect they could be neurodivergent?
Well, to be honest, you listed them all. No, I'm just playing. That's a hard question to answer because there are a million accommodations, but something that I can offer is a process of getting to know yourself. I think it's important to really sit with yourself and learn, like, okay, what do I like? What do I dislike? And then how do both of those things make me feel? I feel like if you're able to get a better understanding of what you like, what you dislike, what things make you uncomfortable, what things make you more comfortable, it gives you a great starting point to start identifying your own specific needs. So for example, like you say, you know, noisy environment might not be something that you're a fan of. And with that information, then you can kind of start going down the list of like, what makes me feel better in noisy environments? Or is it removal from the noisy environment overall? So some things in that scenario that I suggest, and this is something that I do all the time, is if I'm going outside, if I'm about to hit the streets with my friends, I have earplugs attached to my keys at all times. So if the environment is noisy, they right there on my keys. All I gotta do is pop them into my ears. So yeah, really just leaning into learning your own body, learning your body's signs, learning your body signs when it's feeling like it's becoming dysregulated or uncomfortable, and then what you can do to counter that. And a few other suggestions that I have is, one, talk to a professional who's neurodivergent affirming, or talk to a neurodivergent person. Those are some great opportunities to learn what other people have tried and try them out for yourself. Something else that I do when I go outside is I take a pair of shades, because if it's going to be too bright or too crowded or just too much movement, I put my shades on and it kind of reduces what's going on in the room. So yeah, it's a laundry list of strategies. I meal prep, I use fidgets, I make sure to supplement audio with visuals. I also use captions. There's so many things that you can do to accommodate, but it really just boils down to learning what your body needs. Because again, we talked about it in the beginning, it's not, you know, one size fit all. Everybody's brain is different, and everybody, their brain and their body, they need different things. So you just got to kind of do that investigative work to figure out, what is it that my brain and my body need?
All right. Well, did y'all have any final thoughts?
I just want to say thank you so much, Gray, for coming. Thank you for sharing all of your knowledge, your wisdom, your expertise. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm grateful again that y'all have given me the opportunity to socially acceptable info dump, because this is what I like to do. I love to talk about this stuff. So thanks for creating space for me to come on and talk about just the things that feel passionate. Yeah, I appreciate y'all.
I would like to echo what Leah said. I love this conversation. I think more of us should be having this conversation. I think more of us should be reflecting. And yeah, and I also want to reiterate that if you are doing any sort of ancestral work, spiritual work, like that also is connected to yourself. And I think sometimes people unknowingly separate the self from that, but it's all in conversation. You, like, your ancestors want you to be who you are because so many of them couldn't. Like, that's part of healing that ancestral lineage, is undoing the curses of the language we are currently using, which is masking, and trying to fit into a box. Like, we owe it to our lineage to break those chains. No Tasha Cobb, but
I'm screaming.
Absolutely no Tasha Cobb, because y'all remember what she did at the end of that song.
Like, the first time I heard that again, and she was like, break the chains of homosexuality, I was like, where did this come from?
That shit was so disappointing. Like, she ruined that song for me. And so I have never listened to it again. But yeah, we still need to be breaking chains. Not them chains, but it's chains that need to be broken. So yeah. But with that, I guess we will call it an episode.
As always, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, rate, and review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If anything from the show resonate with you, let us know on Twitter at Hoodoo Plants or Instagram at Hoodoo Plant Mamas.
We will see y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Bye.